You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. With an Iraqi delegation watching, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan appealed today for an end to U.S. military occupation as soon as possible and for Iraqis to run their own affairs. We should listen to their needs expressed by them in their terms, and we should try to respond, Annan told the Security Council at the start of a meeting attended by three delegates from Iraq's new governing council. Since the war on Iraq began, several groups of peace activists, including the Human Shields, the Iraq Peace Team, and the women's activist group Code Pink, have sent delegations to Iraq to live amongst the Iraqi people and assess the humanitarian situation. On the group, Reem Kathuda of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C., spoke recently with Code Pink member Gail Murphy about her recent trip to Iraq and what she witnessed.
When I arrived in Iraq in February, I was quite amazed at how calm things were. We had been quite frightened by the impending bombing, but there was a hiatus there, a window of opportunity where we could actually go in knowing that there wouldn't be an attack from the U.S. But it was quite amazing to meet Iraqis face-to-face after so much American media about our desire to bomb them. And as an American, I was really feeling quite sheepish to meet them, but I needed to. I needed to see who is this person that we hate so much. I was amazed at their ability to separate me as an American individual and my government. Iraqis in the Arab tradition are extremely welcoming and very generous and nice people, and so it was very easy to have friendly interactions. It was a really pleasant surprise, and I think it healed me a lot to be able to meet Iraqis, given what Americans were about to do. And so when I came back to Washington, we really fought very hard, as everyone did all over the world, to try and turn the course of events, which we didn't succeed in doing. And the result is absolutely devastating.
So you went back, and what did you see this time?
I saw a very chaotic, dirty, struggling city. I saw many more Iraqis on the street. I saw many more, a greater diversity of Iraqis on the street. And I also had greater access to them. I didn't have a minder this time. I did go wherever I wanted. For the most part, there were moments when U.S. military, the occupying forces that are, and I only went to Baghdad, and they're everywhere. There are checkpoints everywhere. They're guarding hospitals, and so they're set up in entire city blocks where you can't enter. They've taken over large bank buildings, government buildings, and have surrounded themselves quite effectively with barbed wire and heavy artillery, and you really can't access them and you can't photograph them. You can converse with them, and especially as an American, I could approach them and we could have a conversation, and they were actually usually desperate for a conversation with an American.
What did they have to say?
The first thing was how hot it was and how long they'd been there and how they really wanted to go home. They're not happy about the situation, and the period of time that I was there, attacks on U.S. soldiers were on the increase, and they were feeling at greater risk than, you know, the day before. Every day they were feeling the greater pressure and risk of being there and really wanted to go home, and also they didn't know when they were going home, and that was quite frustrating. There's not a lot of good information for either U.S. soldiers on the ground or for Iraqis. Iraqis also were not being told what was going to be done with them, what kind of a government was going to be created, or were they going to be allowed to create. So there was a lot of confusion, a lot of frustration, a lot of anger, a lot of sadness, a lot of just grime from the bombs, from the aftermath of the bombs, and from garbage that's being dumped that isn't being picked up because all basic services have been halted. There is virtually no electricity, or very intermittent, depending on where you live. Extremely limited areas where telephones are working, so communication is really face-to-face. Many stores are closed, and those that are open are staying open only until 2 p.m. It's obviously a city under siege, living extremely difficult times. People are tired. People are unshaven. Water needs electricity. Gas needs electricity. So when the gas pumps are open, the lines for the waiting for the gas are extremely long. And we're talking about 120, 125 degree weather. Same thing with the soldiers. They're living in full uniform, 12-hour shifts a day. under the sun with helmets, gear, 40-pound metal flak jackets, or I guess they're a type of clay. And one told me that for the heck of it, they put a thermometer down, you know, their shirt to take a temperature reading of their body, and it was 145 degrees. And they're sitting on top of tanks at checkpoints. Many of them wear gloves because their guns become so hot they can't even hold them. They can't touch them from the heat of the sun. Very dusty. And the soldiers are eating rations. They're not allowed to go out and eat on the street. They don't have normal interactions with the Iraqis. They're the occupying force. So it's a very inhumane situation for both Iraqis and Americans.
Yet we see pictures here of little children shaking the hands of American soldiers, ambassadors in army gear, says the picture.
Well, I think that's a testimony to the human spirit, that there are individuals who do speak heart to heart. Despite this terrible situation, those individual interactions do occur. There was a group of soldiers protecting a hotel that had been threatened because of its collaboration with the Americans, because many of the journalists and business people are staying there. It's the Palestine Hotel. And street children have taken up residence there and are with the soldiers 24 hours a day. The soldiers feed them. The soldiers wash their hair. And it's really the only kind contact, it seems, that the soldiers can have with Iraqis. And these are street kids who, and they're also troublesome and troubled. A lot of the older kids are sniffing glue and stealing and getting in trouble and getting beaten up and their bones are being broken, and the soldiers take care of them or arrest them. You know, one day they might be friendly with a kid and the next day they're, you know, putting their hands in cuffs and taking them off to detainment. The public sector is shut down. And people still show up to their jobs, although they're not paid. There is no functioning system, public system, except oil and trade. Well, oil. Trade is probably not functioning. We can tell that from the long queues at the gas stations.
So you went down there to open a center to monitor the occupation. Who is staffing your center?
The center is currently staffed by two Iraqi women and two peace volunteers, two Irish women who are also with Voices in the Wilderness, who are supporting the two Iraqi women who are journalists by training. And they are extremely engaged, active, and very well-networked women who are doing research on behalf of the Occupation Watch Center on key issues: security, crime, organized crime, the evolution of the insecurity under occupation. They're investigating human rights abuses that are occurring under the occupation. They're investigating issues related to the economy, particularly unemployment and what impact that's having. They're looking at issues related to women and how are women surviving under the occupation. Obviously, women are not circulating the way they used to. 60% of the public sector employees were women. They're no longer going to work because of the insecurity, murder, rape, robbery, etc. Women are not feeling safe to go about town as they did before. There has been some exaggerated press, I believe, in the United States about the restrictions of women due to religious fervor in Iraq. That may be happening in some quarters, but we didn't really get that sense from women in Baghdad. They're not feeling that they're being told to throw on the scarf and the abaya. But their restriction really comes from the insecurity that the war has created and its aftermath, that there is no police force and no national security.
Do you already have some reports of human rights abuses? What are they and who's doing it?
We interviewed, for example, a family. Their son is a doctor, a veterinarian, and he was going off to work, waiting for a taxi. All of a sudden, he was confronted by a small patrol of soldiers who accused him of attempting to steal a truck and shot him 7-8 times. His brother came to his aid. They threw his brother down, arrested his brother, took the body, and what ensued was a horrible circumstance for the family.
How will the center be communicating with you?
Primarily, we'll be getting reports by email. we will organize ourselves to disseminate the information worldwide. The center is a coalition of organizations. United for Peace and Justice is sponsoring the center, and as you know, that represents over 600 U.S.-based anti-war groups. It also is represented by Global South, a group with multiple offices in Southeast Asia. Bridges to Baghdad is an Italian anti-war group. There's a French Palestinian resistance group that's also joined the efforts. And the World Social Forum, representing some 50 member organizations, is also involved. So these organizations and their constituents are expecting information, timely information on what is going on in Iraq under the occupation.
The International Solidarity Action, ISAM, in occupied Palestine was raided by the U.S. and their computers taken and a lot of their reports. What is the security? How are you ensuring the security of the workers of your center?
The center is currently housed temporarily in a house that was renovated by Voices in the Wilderness in the center of Baghdad. We're awaiting the renovation of an Iraqi partner's art center, and which was destroyed during this war. It had been bombed also in 91. So we're collaborating to renovate this center and hope to house the Occupation Watch Center permanently for the duration of the center, which should be about 18 months. And as far as security is concerned, we really don't have any measures other than what Iraqis are taking currently.
How can our audience read your report?
We do have a website, occupationwatch.org. You can also link to the Occupation Watch Center's website through unitedforpeace.org, which is the website for United for Peace and Justice. We will be uploading the reports, and we will be doing press releases. We'll also be organizing delegations of experts, people who are interested in going to Iraq and doing work on research or whatever their skills can bring in order to gather information. And we aren't just interested in gathering information. We're interested in taking this information and turning it into action. There is a lot of movement at the grassroots in Iraq right now opposing the occupation. We want to support those efforts. There are also lots of efforts going on throughout the world to oppose the occupation. This information is going to contribute to strengthening campaigns that can go on in Iraq and outside of Iraq in opposition to the occupation.
In closing, would you like to share a message?
As an American, I feel particularly responsible to do what I can to mitigate the destruction that has occurred in Iraq and to try and find alternatives to an occupation. I believe the soldiers should leave as quickly as possible. They need to secure the country first, and they need to do that through collaboration with Iraqis and not to work in isolation. And I ask that every listener do what they can, be it contacting their congressperson, be it writing letters to newspapers, sharing information with the widest possible audience in their communities to let them know what the United States government has leashed upon the people of Iraq in such an unfair and inhumane way.
Gail Murphy is a member of the women's activist group Code Pink. She spoke about her recent trip to Iraq with Reem Kathuda of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. In his recent article on the website of the public interest journal TomPaine.com, investigative reporter Jim Loeb presented evidence backing the growing calls for an investigation into the Bush administration's use of faulty intelligence info to justify the war on Iraq. Loeb spoke recently with Pokey Anderson of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston about his research on this topic and on the organized campaign he says is being waged by conservatives to persuade the American public of the other reason for going to war, that is, the alleged link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein.
There's a lot of evidence now that people both within the administration and outside the administration were trying to forge that link in the public mind within hours of the actual attacks on September 11th. And the evidence is mounting up fairly steadily and somewhat dramatically. Wesley Clark, the NATO Supreme Commander, recounted last month on Meet the Press that he was receiving calls on September 11th from people who knew that he was going to be interviewed on CNN and other networks. And he was asked by the people who contacted him to say that this was state-sponsored terrorism, and in that connection to mention the possibility or likelihood of Saddam Hussein as being behind this, no matter who else might have been involved. Well, within 4 days, you have the Camp David meeting of the senior national security staff of Bush, and we know from Woodward's account that Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld were pushing very hard for going after Saddam there, even though there was no evidence. But Wolfowitz kept arguing that there, you know, he must be behind it. And then by September 20th, you have an open letter from the Project for the New American Century, which includes mainly neocons outside the administration, particularly people like Robert Pearl and Kenneth Edelman, who later become the big cheerleaders for war. Sending a letter or an open letter to Bush saying that we should go after Saddam whether or not he's linked to September 11th. There were factions, as I said, within the administration and outside it who were already very much coordinating their activities and trying to frame the issue to implicate Saddam Hussein despite the complete lack of evidence.
Yeah, one of the quotes that has been bandied about was Rumsfeld. Was it the day of the attacks, urging the administration's response to, quote, go massive, sweep it all up, things related and not?
Yeah, that comes from CBS reporter David Martin, who apparently got a hold of Rumsfeld aide's contemporaneous notes on September 11th, which basically showed that Rumsfeld's state of mind was, how can we use this to go after Saddam Hussein? So that was within 5 hours of the actual attack.
So one could argue that, you know, given that PNAC, the Project for New American Century, had already, say, let's attack Iraq in 1998, that, you know, this was not a new idea.
Well, actually, in 98, they weren't saying so much to attack Iraq. They had a kind of different option. They had a kind of scenario which involved solidifying control over the no-fly zones in North and South and using that to launch the Iraqi National Congress of Ahmed Chalabi to launch an attack and just hold American troops in reserve. So that was a kind of glorified covert action, more or less on the Guatemalan model of 1953. But this was more specific. This said we've got to do what we can to remove Saddam Hussein, and if we don't remove Saddam Hussein, we will not be able to say that we've won the war on terrorism. A lot of these people seem to believe very strongly in a thesis that was put forward by a woman named Lori Milroy. She was an Iraq scholar in the 80s who actually was considered quite pro-Saddam, argued in favor of a U.S. close U.S. relationship with Saddam, even argued that Saddam was a moderate. She had interviewed him. But she changed her stripes after the Gulf War and became very, very strongly anti-Saddam and argued in a book that Saddam actually was involved in the 1993 attack and may even, although she didn't endorse this, specifically, but may even be involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. And these guys who got on television, who were associated with the Project for the New American Century, but also very closely associated with Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in particular, were all arguing on September 11th and 12th that Saddam, in Crystal's words, was the elephant in the room, that it must have been him. And they would all go back and refer back to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing as something that Saddam was implicated in. There is a very small minority, I guess, within the national security community that thinks that that Milroy's argument is very interesting and, you know, and potentially, you know, may have something behind it. But generally, the CIA, FBI, as institutions, have all just dismissed it as very unlikely.
You mentioned Chalabi with the Iraqi National Congress, and this is a guy who left Iraq when he was a teenager. Guess been trying to get taken back as the new leader of Iraq, and was kind of an ace in the hole for the people who wanted to go in there as, like, this can be the new leader. Can you talk a little about him and some of the purported intelligence that he was feeding to the highest levels?
His past is a bit controversial. He's a real wheeler dealer. He was convicted of bank fraud. He was a very wealthy man with banking interests all over the Middle East. And then he popped up as the leader of this Iraqi National Congress in 92, and he was kind of their leader when they met in Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq in 1992. the Iraqi National Congress, it's not clear exactly what that is beyond Chalabi. I mean, it's essentially an attempt at an umbrella group that he wants to be the leader of a coalition of forces. In the mid-90s, the CIA was backing the INC and Chalabi, and then they broke with him. They think that he kind of double-crossed them, and they were very angry with him. And essentially, neither the CIA nor the State Department, nor even the DIA at the Pentagon, has really wanted anything to do with him at all. But the neocons, in particular, Pearl, Wolfowitz, and later Rumsfeld, and to some extent still later Cheney, they all kind of managed him or helped, were really lobbyists for him in Washington. And he would bring defectors, which I should put in quotation marks, because it wasn't clear whether they were traveling under a false flag or what kind of a flag they were traveling. But they had many stories to tell about weapons of mass destruction, about ties to al-Qaeda, to essentially establish that Saddam was very bad and was very dangerous. The CIA and the State Department never wanted to have anything to do with these people, and when they did talk with these people, they tended to discredit these people. But they were taken very seriously by the Pearls and the Woolseys and the people in the Pentagon, and the civilians in the Pentagon. And that's where they got their hearing, and of course they spoke always to the intelligence unit that was set up in Rumsfeld's office and overseen by Douglas Feiss and Wolfowitz, led by Abraham Shulsky. They'd go and talk to him, and they obviously told them precisely what the Iraq hawks wanted to hear. They just lapped it right up and believed it, although they couldn't really get it approved through the interagency process, so that in the end, when the president made his case for war, or Powell made his case for war at the UN, the al-Qaeda tie was not very strong, as it should never, as it apparently never was in any event. But the people on the outside, the Crystals, the Pearls, and so on, kept insisting that this was true, that, you know, Mohammed Atta met with a senior Iraqi agent in Prague just 5 months before the attacks, which proved, you know, the tie, or that the fundamentalist group up in northern Iraq, Ansar, was somehow run by an Iraqi intelligence agent, and therefore that was the tie, or that this mistress who had been told by her Saddam's son that Saddam had met personally with Osama in 1995 two times, and had even given him money. And all this stuff was taken very seriously and hyped by the people on the outside, while the people on the inside could not get the CIA to go along with any of this, neither the CIA nor the State Department, nor even the Defense Intelligence Agency.
In an article in The Nation, Robert Dreyfus wrote, it was titled More Missing Intelligence, and he wrote about Chalabi's kind of direct pipeline into the Office of Special Plans, led by Abram Shulsky, and that some of this so-called intelligence was making its way into speeches by, you know, at the highest levels, speeches by Rumsfeld, Cheney, and George W. Bush. But then apparently they have like a sister organization, another kind of almost like a private unit that wasn't the Mossad in Israel, in Sharon's office. He writes, this secretive unit may well have been the source of the forged documents purporting to show about the yellow cake. Appears like there were two kind of small agencies kind of inside high levels trading information outside the normal professional bureaucracy.
In a way, it's not unusual. I mean, highly political leaders, when they come to office, generally do not necessarily trust the professionals that are part of the permanent bureaucracy. So the notion that either Sharon or, say, let's say Rumsfeld in this case, because Bush obviously didn't bring in his own intelligence unit, they often, you know, have informal advisors to bounce off advice or to collect information or have back channels or whatever. So that in itself is not unusual. However, the kind of institutionalization in Rumsfeld's office creating an office, that is fairly unusual. And I think there's much more to find out about that group of people. As for on the Sharon side, again, I find it a credible assertion of the existence of such a group. And certainly the Mossad itself was dismissing a number of allegations, including the al-Qaeda connection that were being put forward in the United States. And I can tell you, the Israeli press is no slouch. I mean, you know, if they sense that there's an intelligence unit that's been in any way formally constituted to exchange information with these guys in the Pentagon, and not just Sharon's buddies or retired Mossad or other intelligence agents from Israel who were conveying messages from Sharon's office, that's something altogether different.
In a recent article that was posted at Asia Times, you asked the question, will the UN bail out Bush? You mentioned a number of letters of the alphabet, the Q word for quagmire, the V word for Vietnam, and the dreaded W word for Watergate. Are we talking bailout here? Is this a quagmire from which Bush cannot escape?
Well, I mean, my own personal assessment is that he's in very deep trouble, the governor of the Occupation Authority. Bremer, on all of the talk shows in Washington today, I thought was very significant because there really isn't anybody else they can call upon to kind of reassure the American people at this point in the administration. And I think, I just think that you have this drip, drip, drip of killings of Americans, and you have Americans on the scene who are soldiers who are so clearly unhappy they're willing to talk publicly about how they feel. By the Army's own admission, they're facing a guerrilla war, which is something that contradicts Rumsfeld. You have the permanent bureaucracy, like the Army, like the CIA, in revolt against the presidency. I mean, and you have an economy that's not doing really well, employment very high. You have a really serious problem in your hands in all this, and I think you have to figure out a way to cut your losses. And I think the only way that you can cut your losses is by getting those Americans out of Iraq or internationalizing the problem as quickly as possible. And I think what you saw last week were the first efforts, or the first kind of tentative feeling out by Powell and his people at the UN, and by Bush himself, who hosted Annan on Monday. I would say that he's in the process of going to the UN to try to get to relieve the responsibility in one way or another. And the question is, what will be the price of the UN Security Council? What do they want in exchange?
That was investigative reporter Jim Loeb speaking with Pokey Anderson of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Loeb writes for Foreign Policy in Focus and the Interpress Service and International Development-oriented Newswire. Thanks to Renee Feltz for production assistance with that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA and Keith Chalgian. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.